and welcome to the coffee table on KBBI AM 890 and KBBI.org. Everybody's got their headphones with the proper headphone jacks plugged into the proper headphone inputs. The topic this morning is opioid addiction in Homer and Narcan and the needle exchange. Jenny Espenshade is here. Jenny, you are executive director of Kenai Peninsula Youth Court, but you are also a part of the needle exchange, right?
Correct. I'm here because I'm a volunteer with the Homer Exchange, our free syringe access program.
And also in the studio, Dr. Sarah Spencer. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
And is addiction your specialty?
Yeah, I'm a family medicine physician, but I also specialize in addiction medicine and mainly treating patients who have an opioid use disorder.
And also, Rob and Annie Wired. Welcome, and thanks for coming. We have an interview to play in a little while with Megan Wired, Rob and Annie's daughter, and you guys, Jenny Espenshade, Dr. Spencer, Annie and Rob, you guys have kind of been on tour together. You guys have a mission, and you are all working together on it. Can anyone volunteer to speak a little bit to that, what you've been working on together?
I can, as the person with the most gray hair, I'll give a little background. Over 2 years ago, there was a lot of conversation, especially among the legal community, about how the opioid problem was showing up, affecting Homer cases and people from our community involved with the legal system. A local defense attorney, Andy Haas, was especially alarmed, and he also does cases in the Central Peninsula. Our law enforcement was concerned about it. We put on, with a professor of psychology at the college, Brian Partridge, and Dr. Spencer, we put on a community forum in April of 2015. And a lot of great information was shared there, but most compelling was the audience urgency. How many segments of our community were touched by that. And then the Homer News partnered with us with some op-eds and then a series of articles. And then people started coming forward, like Rob and Annie, sharing their stories. And one of the things that inspired me at that presentation in 2015 was a new doctor, or new to me, and one of my personal goals was I'm going to do everything I can to support her efforts to make our community healthier.
So right off the bat, I want to welcome anyone who has questions or comments to call in. The number is 235-7721. And you can talk to Jenny or Dr. Spencer or Annie and Rob. Then that'll be going on for the whole hour. We'll be taking questions. But I would like someone, okay, you with the seniority, Jenny, maybe not, maybe you could help, or everyone in the room, to help state this problem and stake it out for the listeners. Like, what is your mission? Why are you doing these forums? And we're going to then get into what Narcan is and what the needle exchange is.
I'll take a stab. Just like many communities across the country, our community is being devastated by addiction to opioids. And there's different paths. Everyone has a different path to that addiction. But one of the striking things about this substance is its potential for addiction and its lethality or potential for overdose. What struck me, and I'm here as a volunteer, so many of the families and people afflicted are young adults that went to school with my daughters. They could be my daughters. And I know there's a lot of commentary about our nation's approach to this is different because these are white kids from the suburbs. And personally, that rings somewhat true with me because these are young adults that I, you know, they were in my carpools for preschool. I coached them in soccer. And so the first thing that struck me is these are our young people that grew up here, and we can do so much better to help the ones that are now struggling with the addiction, but also what we learn from this, we can prevent the next batch.
So when and where is the needle exchange?
The needle exchange is the first and third Tuesday of every month from 5 to 7 p.m. at the South Peninsula Hospital Training Center, which the hospital donates the use of that space. They're great partners with us. That's located across from the heating stove store. It used to be the natural food store.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the back of that building. And it's free, confidential, and it's not just exchanging syringes. We also offer resource information about treatment, information and availability of Narcan, HIV, AIDS, and Hep C testing, hygiene type.
So it's kind of a portal in for people who need other services, who need help, and you can meet them where they are. Or what their needs are.
Yeah, it definitely is. This is Sarah Spencer. So I've met a number of folks there at the exchange who then have come to me, you know, looking for treatment and seeing, you know, how can I get help? What are the steps that I can take? And syringe exchange programs are definitely proven to actually somewhat reduce drug use and increasing interest in accessing treatment greatly reducing the spread of disease in a community. And so it's been a great opportunity for me to build trust among people who otherwise maybe wouldn't seek out treatment services, and for them to come there and have a trusting, non-judgmental environment that they feel free to ask questions and find out information for when they are ready to get help. They know where they can go to get it.
And seeing you at the, well, you're calling it the needle exchange. You said syringe exchange.
I think the most appropriate term is syringe access program.
There you go.
Because really, I mean, the idea of getting dirty needles off the street is a nice idea, but there's a lot of different reasons why people don't carry their dirty syringes around with them all the time or can't always dispose of them in the proper way. And so we'd like people to dispose of their syringes there, but the most important thing is for people to get sterile, clean equipment so that they're reducing the spread of disease. And so the access to sterile equipment is the main goal. Not necessarily, we don't require a one-to-one exchange but we have had increasing numbers of folks returning their used syringes for proper disposal, which has been really nice.
And I know, Jenny Espenshade, you have some information that you brought with you about the cost of treating people and the cost of providing this service,
mm-hmm,
compared to the cost of not providing it. And can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I stole a slide from Dr. Spencer, so I'd rather have her explain
it.
Okay,
if we're talking about syringe access, so syringe access is a very cost-effective way to reduce the cost to society of drug use. And so, and what the cost we're talking about here is the health costs of when people first start using IV drugs. Within that first year, there's about a 30 to 50% chance that they're going to become infected with hepatitis C. And then, depending on where they live, also some risk of HIV if it's going around in that particular community. So the cost of providing sterile equipment for someone who is an IV drug user for an entire year is less than $500. And the cost of treating one case of hepatitis C, which again there's a 50% chance that they're going to catch within that first year, is approaches $100,000. So it's a huge cost savings. You can reduce the spread of hepatitis C by about 30%. So and like treating addiction itself, providing addiction treatment is also a huge cost savings to society.
And I would add to that, if listeners are curious, while the City Council did pass a resolution in December of 2015, supporting syringe access program in Homer, not a dime of city funding goes to our mm-hmm. expenses.
Where does it come from?
We have accessed local grants. The Awesome Foundation, Alaska Branch, donated. We had a startup grant from the North American Syringe Exchange Network, and now we have 2 or 3 years worth of supplies thanks to a mental health trust fund grant. But all the grant writing has been volunteer. All the staffing at the exchange is volunteer, except the testing staff. They're co-located by Family Planning Clinic, and that's part of their mission too, but they partnered with us to place them there at the exchange for rapid testing.
And so I would like to make this personal for everyone, because we're talking about what's available and I want to get back to that, but I spoke on the phone yesterday with Megan Wired, who is Rob and Annie's daughter, and she is in Austin. Anyone who grew up around these parts or lived around these parts might remember Megan. I remember her very well from when she was a little girl. So I have this, it's about 8 minutes of Megan telling her story about opioid addiction.
Megan Wired, the first time I met you, you couldn't have been 12. You were probably 11 years old or 10, and you were a smart, fun, awesome kid at theater camp.
Oh, yeah, that was a long time ago.
I think that was the summer of 2000. But I have heard bits of your story since then, because you've been really vocal. Do you consider it part of your recovery to be out there telling your story to people?
Yeah, I have no shame in anything I've done, been through, and I think that by talking about it and making other people aware, it helps them have an experience and into a better life. It started as an eating disorders as a little kid, and then it progressed in my freshman year in high school. I started drinking and smoking pot. And at that point, it felt sort of like I was experimenting, except I was different than most of my friends, is that the first time that I drank is the only time that I felt normal, like in my entire life. And so I just never stopped. It wasn't like, hey, guys, let's, drink a little bit. I just drank to get smashed. And so that went on for a little while. I was able to sort of get my act together later in high school, graduated, did all right for about a year after high school, and then I just started to get really depressed. Just basically nothing made me feel better. It was like the eating disorder wasn't helping anymore. Losing enough weight wasn't making me happy. The boyfriend wasn't making me happy. Clothes, money, anything. None of that stuff was working for me anymore. And at that point, that's when I started reaching for drugs. And I went to a party Memorial Weekend out in Anchor Point, and that is the first time that I did coke. And right then, it was off and running. Like, I started doing pills same day, started smoking crack.
So your experience was not that this was some sort of little by little gradual thing that you fell into.
I mean, in my experience, you're a real drug addict or alcoholic, you don't just go lightly with it, because without the dope and the alcohol, we feel completely empty. I had no real friends, I wasn't good enough, I couldn't do anything in this world. I moved on pretty quickly to OxyContin. It's normal. Like, I think about 2 weeks into my OxyContin use, I got dope sick. And after that, it was like I lost everything. Lost the car, lost the job. My parents they knew obviously something was going on with me, but I finally told them, I needed to go to treatment and I had to get better. Looking back at it, it was like, in reality, I mostly wanted to get sober at that point because I wanted them to continue enabling me.
Can you explain a little bit what you mean by that?
My parents were my biggest drug dealers for 14 years. they provided the money that I went to go get dope. They provided money to get my friends high. They provided money for me to stay in hotels and get high. They bought me the car. They bought me the apartment. They kept paying my cell phone bills, and they were killing me, you know. And I think that a lot of families, especially from what my mom has said, they don't get it. I used and I went as hard as I could, and it was in the last year and a half, 2 years, when my mom finally said no and stopped giving me money that I got sober. It's a family recovery, you know. It's not just the addict. It's the entire family has to be a part of it, because there's just so many different dynamics to addiction. Because I know that if my parents' love, which was very great and they showed me, could have saved me, then I would have got sober right away.
Could you talk a little bit about where and how and when you found recovery?
I came to Austin to go to a treatment center here when I was 21, and I did not take the program seriously. Gained a little weight, got some food, had a place to stay, made some friends, thought everything was looking up. My parents, you know, were going to help pay for things again, and so I left early.
That's a pretty common reaction, isn't it? Doesn't it often take a few tries?
Yes. Absolutely. I mean, I don't know a lot of people that get it the first go around, but the seed gets planted, basically,
right,
is what happened for me. I left treatment. I relapsed 8 months later, and I went straight to heroin. I went with heroin for a long time. I tried to be put on Suboxone and all that, and while going through that, trying to get off of heroin, I just started doing meth instead, because there's some medications that if you take the opiate, you get sick. In that time, I became homeless, and I was living on the streets in Austin, and, you know, I could not stop doing dope. I was in and out of jail. I was in the hospital in meth psychosis, begging for money on the street. Like, finally, I got arrested, and they wouldn't give me a bond because I kept jumping bonds so many times. My lawyer basically was like, you can go to prison or you can go to treatment. And my first reaction was, well, I told him I'm going to go to prison because I can still get high in there, you know, and that's how strong addiction is. I was in jail for about a month. He came and asked me one more time, and he was like, hey, your parents are willing to help you out one more time, and if you want to go to treatment, we can get you there. I agreed to go to treatment, and I went to this program, and it saved my life. Like, it was definitely the hardest thing I've ever done.
But that was the one that worked.
Yeah, I mean, this place, it was an intense recovery center, you know, but they broke down my ego enough that I could be built back up into an actual human being. Because, like, the lies that I was feeding myself was, like, eventually I'll be okay, and this is fun. I'm, you know, walking around on meth, like, having fun in the middle of the night in the parks. And
in a way, in your addiction, you were seeing it as an adventure?
Right. Like, I, you know, like, in a sense of, like, protection, I had created these illusions that this lifestyle was fun. I fought the program for about a month and a half, 2 months in, and I didn't really want to be there, and I still wanted to get high, but at that point, you know, my parents had stopped enabling me, so I had no choices, and I knew where I would end up if I left, so I just stuck it through, and eventually it just clicked, and I got willing. Like, I got to a place of brokenness while I was sober, and there were no drugs to take away the feelings I was having, you know, and I became willing to take the suggestions that they were giving me.
How long were you there?
I was there for 4 months. I lived in their sober living apartments for 9 months. They recommend 3, but I stayed longer. I did their recovery coaching program where they, you know, someone helped me out for a certain amount of months. I just kept working my way up. You know, I started with a flip phone, riding the bus, and working at Subway, you know, for minimum wage. And just started working my way up, and they helped me along the way, and eventually I got a job there. And so I worked there for a while. We're still all really, really close.
What is your life like now?
Oh, my God, my life. Wake up at 5:30 in the morning, and I meditate, and I get ready for work. I go to work, and I do some groups with some of the women in the treatment center. I work at a different treatment center now. Come home, go to the gym, make dinner, go to the grocery store, like that type of normal stuff. I mean, I know there's not a lot in Alaska, but if there's any way to get out of state into a treatment center, I would always recommend that. Talk about it. If you are ready to get sober, like, you have got to start talking and asking for help and start letting go of some of that shame about addiction. That's, like, one of the biggest things when you can reach out and get vulnerable about what's going on is when you can really start accepting help.
It's such a risk, too.
Oh, yeah. It's terrifying because these are secrets that we've protected for so many years. I would just encourage families to really look into Al-Anon and not enabling their kids and what that really means.
Okay, I really appreciate your help. Thanks so much.
Have a good night.
You too, Megan. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So that is Megan Wired. She spoke to me yesterday from Austin, but Megan's parents, Rob and Annie, are in the studio right now. So welcome and thank you so much for coming, because Megan brings up some points that I absolutely wanted to hear from you guys about. Obviously, you are fully invested in getting out there and talking about your experience, because you've done the community forums and things. They can't be easy to hear no matter how many times you've heard it. But I do want to talk to you about what Megan said about enabling. So how do you know, how can you tell the difference between helping your kids and harming them by giving them too much?
Well, in my experience, since I was the greatest enabler to Megan.
What does that mean?
That means that now that I know more about it, I had a sense that I had failed her somewhere, because I could see she was struggling, you know, for a while. So as a mother who decided to blame herself, I was going to save her no matter what. And so that was my issue. That was my problem. But my problem became this great enabling problem where, by quote unquote saving her, I was going to give her money. Money must make it easier. My gosh, that'll do it. And then I was going to give her a place to live, because then she'd be safe. And even though I didn't really understand at the time what she was doing with all that, but I thought if I just kept giving enough, if I could just give her the world, I could show her how much I love her, and then she would get better. And it just took me a long time to realize that no amount of love I had for her was going to stop what was happening. By the time we figured out what was going on, it was a rude awakening to think that a mother's love wasn't going to save her child. I was like, what? That's why we're parents. We're supposed to protect them. That is what we do. That's our job. Our love is supposed to take care of everything. And once I got that, it was devastating for a while. I thought, holy cow. And then the other thing I really got was, everything I was doing, by giving her money, by doing anything to help her do her drugs, I was hurting her. I was helping to hurt my child. And to ask a parent to wrap their brain around that, it's a very, very difficult concept, and it's illogical. So it's illogical in that I had to stop giving her money and let her figure it out on her own. But if you look at it with a different point of view, I was teaching her to understand that she was capable by herself. I handed it all back to her, put it in her lap, and gave her the opportunity to be the adult she was by that time, make her own choices, and have it be her own responsibility. And I could no longer be responsible for helping to hurt her. I didn't want any more to do with that. It had to be totally up to her what she did.
Well, where did that, I also want to hear from you too, Rob, but where did that realization come from that you had to stop providing the tools for Megan to use?
Well, you know, the thing with people struggling with addiction is there's a long trail of destruction behind them, and they will burn a lot of bridges. They can be very cruel, and they can be very unkind, and they steal, they do all these things that you just can't imagine your child would ever do. And so at some point, and with Rob's help, I mean, you know, there's Rob, I'll let him explain to his side a little bit, but at some point we both got really angry. And I thought, wow, I am really angry. And it wasn't until I started getting angry and deciding I needed to have some self-respect for me. And so it took a while for me to realize I had no respect for myself. And I had so much my own shame and isolation going on. But it took getting angry with her in the situation to get me to turn around.
So no one advised you about this, about withdrawing support, or you got angry and realized
that was the way? As weird as it sounds, the only information we really had was that TV show Intervention. And that's where I started figuring out enabling. And Rob and I would watch it and we'd think, wow, that's what we're doing as a family. And
easy
wow,
to see in someone else, isn't
wow,
it?
Wow, you know. So, yeah, that show, I know it's controversial in some ways, but that show was our information. And that is how we did our own little mini intervention, and that's how she got to Austin. So it worked for us.
And, Rob, I'd love to hear from you a little bit about your experience.
Well, while this was all going on, I just kind of reverted back to a workaholic attitude and just worked harder. You know, make more money, keep the money flow. Go to Annie, she'll take care of Megan, it'll all come around. You know, and at a certain point, you realize there's just never enough money. And when it got to the point where it was a drain on our, you know, basically all of our finances for anything that we wanted to do, I think that was kind of when we started really looking at it a little closer and knowing that we had to make a change.
And are you, so obviously you participate in programs and forums to try to share your experience with people, but are you also, do you avail yourself of groups of 12-step or support groups, like for your own?
You know, I really very, very much support Al-Anon. And that has been really helpful. I'm not a huge goer to the meetings. And as crazy as it sounds, once I got the picture about enabling and being functional, that really helped me. I've just marched forward from there. But I think it's a wonderful program. I encourage everybody involved to go. And I do, it's not to say I don't go, but anything that helps a parent to come out of their own shame and embarrassment and isolation, anything that will help that, I encourage people to do, which is why we started speaking out, so that people, parents, wouldn't feel alone as we had. We had felt completely alone, and we just didn't understand anything. So that's why we started speaking out, to offer peer support for other parents who are going through the same thing, and to encourage them not to feel ashamed. They didn't cause it, they can't control it, and they can't cure it, but they can take care of themselves.
Well, thanks. Thanks so much for coming. And Jenny Espenshade, I sense you have something you'd like to add.
I just want to add that when we started discussing this as a community, one of the concerns was the stigma that so many of us grew up in a time when addiction was a moral failure. That was what everyone understood, and that's what we based our reactions to it. So families like the Wyards, and I'm sure I saw Annie and Rob during those years, although Annie said she rarely left the house. I had no idea, and I regret that we as a community weren't more aware of these issues. And that's one thing the community can change. And each individual person can think about how they would feel if their child were going through this. The good news is courageous people like Annie and Rob and Megan have shared their story. They put it in the Homer News a year ago. If you go to the state health department's tab about opioid addiction, there's links to those articles as a state resource. And I was very fearful that would not be a positive step for them and their family, but the reverse has been true, and the community has embraced and celebrated their courage. And I think that's the start, that's what our community is about. And so I'm gratified, and I'm so thankful to families like that, that this problem cuts across all segments of our community. But I can tell you, these are young people. Many of them grew up among us, and that they don't feel like, some of them feel like they can't come back here because it's not a community that supports recovery. We can change that.
That leads me right where I was hoping to go next. Dr. Spencer, Megan mentioned Suboxone.
Yeah.
That's it. And what is that?
Suboxone.
I can't even pronounce it.
Suboxone is the most common brand name of the medication, which is actually called buprenorphine, which is the most effective medication to treat opioid dependence that we have available in the Southern Kenai Peninsula. It's not the only option. There's also naltrexone, which is Vivitrol. And it doesn't work for everyone, you know. And one of the things she mentioned is, you know, I couldn't use opiates anymore because I was on this medication, so then I turned to meth. And that's when we're taking, you know, when we're helping our patients at the clinic, and seeing them every week, that's a constant battle of the addiction part of your brain is always looking to latch on to it, to something to be addicted to. And so, the relapse rate, if people don't take any medications and don't continue on any therapy after they leave, say, a course of a 28-day detox rehab program, within the first year, 95% of people are going to relapse to opiate use. And buprenorphine reduces that relapse rate to about 40 to 50%.
That's significant.
So it's a huge, huge improvement. And again, you know, it doesn't work. There's half of the people that it doesn't work for, but it's really the best tool that we have to offer right now. Naltrexone, the Vivitrol shot, reduces the relapse rates less, but about 20% or so of people will be able to stay sober on that medication. So having a medication treatment available to the folks who are ready to access that treatment is critical, because it makes a huge difference in their success rates, and it's a huge difference to the cost of cost to society of addiction. You know, untreated addiction is incredibly expensive to society. The studies show, you know, it's probably $40,000 to $50,000 a year that addiction, each person who has untreated addiction costs us. And the cost for treating addiction, it's a cost savings. Every dollar you put into treating addiction saves like $8 to $10 in cost to society. So we need to be making it more available to the people who are ready to access that.
And you have been involved in training people. You said you trained over 200 people in the area to use Narcan. Can you explain what that is and how it works?
So there's three main parts when we're dealing with addiction, the opioid epidemic. There's three important things to remember. One is prevention, so trying to reduce inappropriate prescribing practices, trying to educate people on the risks of use in young people. The second is treatment, accessing treatment, medication-assisted treatment and rehab and those resources. And the last is harm reduction. So harm reduction is keeping people alive until they can get to the point where they're ready to access treatment. And so keeping people alive means, one, hopefully, you know, reducing the chance that they're going to get a life-threatening infection like HIV through sterile equipment, and another is reducing the chance of overdose death. And so when folks are addicted to opioids, their mortality rate is about 10 times higher than someone else their age. And we've seen, you know, in Alaska, just in the last 5 years, heroin deaths are 10 times higher than they were 5 years ago. And so Narcan, naloxone, is the antidote to reverse an overdose. So it saves someone's life so they can get to the emergency room, get the help they need, and then hopefully live long enough to be able to access treatment when they're ready. The state of Alaska received a large grant to help to distribute and train people how to use Narcan. And so I've been helping out with that program, teaching classes all around the Kenai Peninsula.
And who are the people that you're training to use it?
Lots of different people.
Educators or who?
Yeah, so I always train all my own patients, because when you are a person, you know, when you're accessing treatment or leaving rehab, or if you're in treatment but then leave and have a relapse, the overdose death rate is 30 times higher in those first 2 weeks that you do leave treatment. So I always train my own patients, and then any family members who are interested, you know, if they have parents or loved ones that come with them, train them how to use it. I train folks who are like substance abuse counselors, people. I train the Homer Police Department, and they saved someone. And then really anyone in the community that's interested. Like, I train the library staff, because folks use, you know, public restrooms are a very common place that overdoses happen. So, and the folks down at the harbor, we had a couple overdoses a few months ago down in the harbor and on the boats. And so teaching the folks down at the harbor and some of the ship captains how to use that, because if they are out at sea and someone has an overdose, they need to be able to respond to save that person's life until EMS, you know, can get to them, and that can be a while.
Now, you said something leading into that. I do want to get to recovery and treatment, but you said the first line of defense is trying to reduce prescription opioids.
Yes. So prescription, the since 1996, when OxyContin was released by Purdue Pharma and heavily marketed, and there were a lot of changes in policies among hospitals and the way we treated pain and recommendations, a lot of complicated reasons, but the prescribing of opioids increased dramatically, you know. And it used to be very rare that they were prescribed for chronic pain, but it had gotten to the point where a few years ago there was 250 million prescriptions annually for opioids. And if you track the opioid addiction and deaths track right along the sales of the opioids. And so this last year was the very first year with a lot of changes that we've made, like in the CDC recommendations around prescribing education of physicians, the first time we actually saw a reduction in opioid prescribing from 250 million to 225 million prescriptions per year. So that is just finally starting to head in the right direction. But unfortunately, right around that same time, we have very cheap, very dangerous heroin that is available in Alaska and across the nation. So so the folks who can no longer find a prescription opioid on the street, or it's too expensive to buy on the street, buy the heroin instead. So there's just a shift from one opioid to another there. And a lot of people, I've seen greatly increasing numbers of people in the last few years who traditionally people would start on prescription opioids, like through their doctor, they had an accident, they got hurt, they got started on prescription opioids, or maybe they were experimenting with it with their friends and got hooked on them, and then moved to heroin as their addiction became more severe. And I'm seeing a lot more, since heroin is so cheap now, available to a recreational drug to even very young people who don't have a lot of money, I'm seeing a lot more people who start out originally using heroin as a recreational drug before they ever tried prescription opiates, and then just immediately becoming hooked on heroin.
And Jenny, I saw you taking notes earlier. I didn't talk to you about this before, but I'm just wondering, do you see, you are the director of the Kenai Peninsula Youth Court, do you see the kids who are coming through youth court having these issues? Or are those issues separate from what youth court deals with?
We deal with much less serious minor consuming alcohol, and maybe small amounts of marijuana. I will tell you that I see young adults struggling with these substances that, A, were offenders as juveniles, but also volunteers in my program. And that, to me, is real telling that it cuts across.
That it's everyone is at risk.
No one's immune to this.
So I do want to move on now to recovery and the lack of access to services in the area. Jenny, you had said it earlier that often when people do complete rehab and such, they are afraid to come back to Homer because there aren't there isn't much that people can access here. I want to start, before we go into this, with 2 minutes from last night's Borough Assembly meeting. This is Jay Bechdel, who is the new Executive Director of South Peninsula Behavioral Health Services, and he spoke at the Borough Assembly meeting, and this is part of his exchange with Assemblymember Willie Dunn.
Hey, thanks for coming by, Jay. And, you know, the thing that I hear over and over again in the Southern Kenai Peninsula is the lack of option for treatment facilities for substance abuse. Also wanted to, even without local options for treatment, helping to get folks into treatment outside of the Southern Kenai Peninsula, whether they come up to Soldotna or Anchorage or out of state, still pretty overwhelming, especially for high needs people and homeless people. You know, they often have to go to 2, 3, 4 different agencies to even get ready to go to a treatment center. So can you just touch base on that a little bit?
We have services that are provided by an agency like mine, which allows you to get services if you have another condition. For instance, if you have a mental illness or if you have a developmental disability, you can get drug or alcohol treatment in conjunction with those at my agency. We do not offer a standalone drug program. The hospital is in the process of preparing to offer a detox program that will be a very short-term detox program, but once it is over, they will ask you to leave. They will hope you do well on your own after detoxing. So there's a big gap there because the need is for rehab. You need a lot of support and a lot of education coming out of that detox program. I do know that in the Soldotna Kenai area, the Central Peninsula Hospital is doing a very good job of expanding their role there, and I believe they've just opened or about to open a new rehab facility, and I know that there are several in Anchorage as well. Getting in is good luck. You sort of have to catch it at the right time. It's like a parking place. You know, if the guy's pulling out as you're pulling up, you're in good luck. If you're not, you may be waiting for a while. I don't have data on how long you might have to wait, though. Sorry about that.
I just have a quick question, Jay. So is there an opportunity for some partnering, that transition where we would be able to communicate well on when an opening's coming or not? Or how does that work with you partnering with other areas rather than just driving around and hoping that space opens up?
If you have a partnership, you can much more simply, if there is one doorway and you can get into a program that is partnered efficiently and effectively with a bunch of other programs, then you're in one door. And where the opening is and where the need is, you can move that client, that patient, that customer to those services quickly and efficiently. I think we do it pretty well with a few of the local agencies that we work with in Homer. I'd like to expand that because we don't have the resources to provide all those services.
And I would like to say that Central Peninsula Hospital has not yet opened their facility, is what I heard at the meeting last night, but that it's coming. And that what is coming for South Peninsula Hospital is a very short-term detox, because when someone is trying to quit drugs or alcohol, it's life-threatening. You need medical supervision. But I would like to hear from Dr. Spencer, Jenny, and you guys, the Wairds, about what is available in this town, because there's no rehab to go to in Homer. And on the upside, it is sometimes necessary for people to leave every single thing about their lives in order to recover. On the downside, that means that so many people don't have access to what they need in order to get well. So can you talk a little bit about what is available and what isn't available in Homer?
Sure. So in Homer, we have outpatient resources, meaning, you know, there are counselors, substance abuse counselors available. There are doctors like myself and a few others that can help people manage their medications. You know, if there is a life-threatening detox situation, you know, we can get people into the hospital for a few days to manage that. But really, I think, you know, as far as rehab, if someone needs to go to rehab, the closest is Serenity House in Soldotna, you know, again, your traditional 1 month stay is the most common. Although if folks, like, for example, if I have someone who's doing well on Suboxone as far as avoiding opiates, but they're having another problem, say alcohol or meth, that medication doesn't address, and they really need to go to rehab for that problem, they can't take their medication when they're at Serenity House. They can't take their buprenorphine, and so that's not even an option for them. Like, Clithro is one of the only places in Rainforest, so they have to go out of the area for that.
I hadn't even considered that.
Yeah, and that, but you know, that really is just, rehab is, I mean, everyone talks about rehab, and rehab is vital when people need to be separated from their daily lives to focus on themselves and refocus, you know, their minds, and be out of the situation that's dangerous and unhealthy for them for a short period of time. But, you know, there are a lot of folks who can't get into rehab or don't necessarily need to go to rehab, but they need a safe place to be living. And for my folks that I treat as outpatient, you know, they come to see me in the doctor's office. They have a regular doctor's visit, and they do their counseling. But a lot of these folks come, you know, so broken from a social standpoint. You know, they have estranged their friends and family, and really the only folks they have around them, say, to give them a safe place to sleep and that sort of thing, are people who are also using drugs. And so what we, I think, one of our most pressing needs, and it's a very, I think, attainable goal, would be to establish sober living, housing in Homer. We don't have that at all. So if I have folks that are coming to me, homeless folks, but even folks that are not technically homeless, but they may be living with a partner or a family member or friends who are currently using, they have to get out of that situation. But they don't, you know, they're sick, they've been sick, they're not currently working, they don't have enough money to get an apartment on their own. They need that temporary housing, a safe place that's a sober living facility, so that they can focus on, you know, on getting better. And that's a huge lack of services that we have in this community.
And Jenny, is there something you want to add to that?
I would echo that. I've gone to some of the town hall meetings up in Kenai and actually seen young adults from Homer that are in the early stages of recovery. And they, to a person, they say, if, you know, I've got to stay up here because I'm in transitional housing or sober living, and there's no such opportunity here. It's definitely doable. There's several models. There's some that are done by agencies. There's one that a husband and wife up in Kenai just set up one. It's also a huge component of folks getting out of incarceration. And there's a reentry group working on the wraparound services. The thing that I've learned, one of many things I've learned from Annie and Rob and Megan, is, you know, there's the physical addiction and dealing with that and the withdrawal and the triggers, but there's so many other social obstacles, and that the sober living could be a place where you are offering that guidance, a safe place, a place that is just based on not using, and so you've got that peer support too. So I do think, at least in the near future, that would be something that Homer could be working on. And there are people that could come, and you know, the triggers aren't all negative, but some of the people that these addicts, these people with addiction, have their closest friendships, they go back to preschool. But if we can, as a community, get educated that how you can, that friendship can be a plus in their life. And
well, one of the things I kept running up on this week in doing research was the scorn that is heaped upon people who are trying to deal with their addiction, and the arguments that there's no reason to help people, that if they can't do it on their own, that there's no reason to waste resources. Now, we talked a little bit about that, because it's actually saving money to help mm-hmm. people deal with their addiction. But what do we do as a community about the stigma?
I think that education is the most important thing, and getting everyone to talk about their experiences, and, you know, because so many people are dealing with it. I think almost everyone, you know, knows someone who's dealing with this, and the more we talk about it, the more we reduce the stigma.
And what were you going to say?
I just wanted, you know, the stigma is huge for the person struggling with the addiction and their families. And people, as Dr. Spencer said, there needs to be more education. This isn't a moral weakness. It's not about willpower. It's about actual changes in the brain chemistry, and nothing can change that but those in addiction themselves with support. So the biggest thing is, not a willpower issue. So I just want to say that.
I also try to stay mindful that we don't know people's stories. And maybe some of the people that have the strongest feelings of, you know, I've been told I coddle people with addiction because I make cookies for them when I volunteer at the exchange. I don't know if the person saying that has had a family that's been devastated by similar issues and that they had to make a line for themselves like Rob and Annie did, but then they're now applying that line to everything associated with this issue. So I try to be mindful of that and respect that I don't know their story, but it is discouraging, and it undermines the progress we have made in the community. I also fear that it's becoming politicized because it's very wrapped in the healthcare issue nationally and statewide. So I just think as a community, we're a community that cares about each other. And this is, if you're not comfortable helping with the reduction of harm or supporting that, surely you'll be comfortable helping on the prevention end. So I would tap into that instead of, you know, and continue to educate why I think it's a public health issue across the board.
Well, we have come to that time in the hour when I'm asking for links and options. Where do you send someone who is looking for help or is trying to help someone who needs treatment? In Homer, I mean. Like, where would you send me today if I said to you, I need help right now?
So the first thing is to get an assessment. You know, what are your needs? How severe is your disease? And, you know, what problems are you dealing with? What substances and what other diagnosis? Because that makes a big difference on where you're going to go to get help. And so the Self Peninsula Behavioral Health, you know, if you are, and many folks with addiction are dealing with a mental health. Almost all of my patients, you know, they have anxiety and depression or other pre-existing more serious mental health conditions. That is one of the risk factors that, you know, has led to their lives falling apart, you know. And so with that, you can go in. There are walk-ins where you can walk in first thing in the morning to the behavioral health center and ask to be seen, you know, as an urgent walk-in that day to get on the schedule and get an assessment of your needs.
And it doesn't matter which came first, the mental health issue or the addiction issue.
Yes,
right.
Yeah. And then we're at our clinic in Nanilchik. We are always happy to meet with folks. So you would, you know, call us and talk with me and schedule a general appointment to talk about, you know, what is going on, to see, you know, we can help to direct people to what would be the best treatment depending on what's going on in their health right now.
And Jenny Espenshade?
I have some meeting times for peer support groups. The Al-Anon Family Group, Tuesdays noon to 1, and Thursdays 6:15 to 7:15 at the Homer United Methodist Church right there next to the high school. Annie gave me a great website, addictsmom.com, all one word, addictsmom, free online support group connecting mothers. And then Ketchumak Bay Narcotics Anonymous, Homer, KBNA@gmail.com. If you want information about the syringes, the exchange dates, the Narcan trainings, HomerExchange@gmail.com. And feel free to use that email to ask any follow-up questions. We put the notices about the exchange openings on the Homer Communications Facebook, and I've gotten some interesting comments, and I'd be glad to try to answer questions or you know, I'm not an expert on this. I'm just
but you're deeply involved.
I've learned a lot, and I confess I had misgivings at first. Was a syringe access program.
And what were your misgivings?
The same that some folks have commented, is this going to encourage people to inject drugs? And the studies have shown it doesn't. All it does is help them be safer and fight the spread of disease. And also it's a step in the door where some volunteers are going to be supporting you being safe, and when and if you're ready to take the next step, we help.
So, Jenny Espenshade, Dr. Sarah Spencer, The Wireds, Rob and Annie, thank you so much. I'm Kathleen Gustafson. This has been The Coffee Table, and the time is 10 a.m.
Jesse Thorne.